Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. If you've ever, looked up at the night sky and felt that mix of just, wow, wonder, but also total confusion about how to actually see anything cool, well, this deep dive is definitely for you. Today, we're pointing our gaze upwards, taking a close look at Jeff Cottrell's fantastic guide for aspiring stargazers, telescopes.
Yeah, our mission today is pretty straightforward. We want to give you a shortcut, really, to understanding the most important tool for looking at the cosmos. We're aiming to turn that passive wonder, just looking up, into something more active, confident exploration where you understand your gear and why it matters. And honestly, this kind of knowledge is so crucial right now. Cottrell points out something really important. The astronomy market can be, well, a bit of a minefield for beginners. People get stuck on the technical jargon, overwhelmed by all the choices, and sometimes fooled by marketing gimmicks, the ones promising crazy high magnification.
Exactly. And that confusion often leads to frustration, and maybe that expensive telescope just gathering dust somewhere.
Right. So this deep dive, drawing on Cottrell's book, aims to give you that solid foundation, help you avoid those costly pitfalls.
Now, what makes Cottrell such a great guide here is that he's not coming from, a purely academic angle. He's not a professional astrophysicist. His authority really comes from decades of hands-on experience. Just being a passionate amateur astronomer out there under the stars, figuring things out, he's got this deep practical wisdom. I love that he calls himself a fellow traveler. It feels right. He gets the common problems, the confusing bits, because he's been there himself.
Mm.
His goal seems to be building this accessible bridge for regular folks into what can feel like a super technical field. It's practical wisdom from the ground up, not just theory.
Yeah, and the core idea in telescopes is really empowering. It's this observational astronomy. It's actually profoundly accessible if you have the right knowledge and, crucially, the right kind of instrument. Cottrell sees the telescope as this democratic tool for discovery. It makes the universe tangible, moves it from being just an idea in a book to something real, something you can see.
The way the book is structured is really smart, too. It feels like a logical journey. It starts with history, Galileo, Newton, then basic optics, light, aperture, focal length. Then it builds out from there, covering the three main types of telescopes, the accessories, the mounts, which are super important, and wraps up with how to actually observe stuff and even dip your toes into astrophotography.
Ultimately, the book isn't just about technical how-to. It's about building a deeper appreciation. For the physics, the engineering, the history behind that window you're looking through, you kind of walk away understanding why things look the way they do. It's more profound that way.
Okay, let's get into some of those crucial concepts right away. Fundamentally, what does a telescope do? Cottrell breaks it down into three main jobs: gather light, resolve detail, and magnify. Simple enough.
Yeah.
But of those three, aperture, that's the diameter of the main lens or mirror, that's the absolute king. He uses his great analogy.
The bucket analogy.
Yeah. The aperture is like a bucket collecting rainwater. A wider bucket catches more water in the same amount of time. Simple as that. So a bigger aperture gathers more light. And light-gathering power, well, that's the real currency of the universe. It decides what faint things you can actually pull out of the darkness.
And understanding that, the importance of light-gathering immediately helps us tackle that classic beginner mistake, chasing magnification.
Right. The magnification myth is just a calculation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Telescope focal length divided by eyepiece focal length.
Exactly. It's secondary.
And here's the trap Cottrell warns about. People think higher magnification automatically means better views. But if your scope is small and you try to magnify too much,
you're just spreading that limited light too thin. You get a big, blurry, dim image, what Cottrell calls empty magnification.
Yeah, empty magnification. That's the key lesson, isn't it? Don't chase power, chase light. Brightness and clarity beat sheer size every time.
So if aperture is the big physics takeaway, the next big practical lesson is understanding the three main families or designs of telescopes. They all connect back to history. First up, we have refractors. These use lenses, like Galileo's original designs.
Okay, lenses. What are the upsides?
Well, they generally give really sharp, high-contrast views. Fantastic for things with lots of detail, like the moon, planets, Jupiter's bands, Saturn's rings, that sort of thing. Plus, they're pretty low maintenance because the tube is sealed off from dust and moisture.
Okay, sounds good. What's the catch? Is it just the price? They tend to be pricey,
right? Yeah, price is definitely a big factor. They are the most expensive per inch of aperture, generally speaking. But optically, the main drawback, especially in simpler designs, is something called chromatic aberration.
Chromatic aberration. What's that in plain English?
Think of it like, well, sometimes with cheaper camera lenses, you see a slight purple or colored halo around bright objects, like a bright star or the edge of the moon.
Ah, okay. Like the colors aren't focusing perfectly together.
Exactly. Blue light might focus just slightly differently than red light. It's an inherent issue with simple lenses bending different colors of light by slightly different amounts.
Got it. So that leads us to the second family, reflectors. These use mirrors, right? Newton's big innovation.
Precisely. Newton figured out that mirrors reflect all colors of light the same way. So boom, no chromatic aberration. That's a huge advantage. And the other massive pro, they give you the most aperture, the most light gathering power for your money, by far.
So reflectors are generally better for fainter things, like galaxies and nebulae.
Definitely. If you want to see faint, fuzzy deep sky objects, a reflector often gives you the best bang for your buck in terms of aperture size. And Cottrell rightly points out the Dobsonian mount here. It's basically a simple, sturdy, wooden alt-azimuth mount, kind of like a lazy Susan for telescopes.
Ah, the Dobsonian. I've heard of those. They made really big reflectors affordable, right?
Totally revolutionized amateur astronomy. Suddenly, huge apertures were within reach for many people.
Okay, so what's the trade-off with reflectors then? There's always a trade-off.
Maintenance. Because the tube is typically open, the mirrors can get dusty over time, and more importantly, they need occasional collimation.
Collimation. That sounds technical. What is it?
It's just aligning the mirrors precisely, making sure the primary mirror at the bottom is perfectly aimed at the secondary mirror near the top, which then directs the light to your eyepiece.
So if I get a reflector, I need to learn how to adjust the mirrors. Is that hard?
Cottrell reassures readers it sounds more intimidating than it is. It's a skill you learn, like tuning a guitar. There are simple tools, like laser collimators, that help. It's just part of owning a reflector, the price you pay for that big, affordable aperture.
Okay, makes sense. So refractors, reflectors.
Mm.
What's the third family?
The third group are the hybrids, or catadioptrics. These use both mirrors and lenses. The most common types are Schmidt Cassegrains, SCTs, and Masutov Cassegrains, or MACs.
Hybrids. Why combine mirrors and lenses?
The main advantage is making the telescope incredibly compact and portable for its optical power. They use corrector lenses and multiple mirrors to fold the light path inside a short tube.
Fold the light path?
Yeah, imagine bouncing the light back and forth inside the tube. So a telescope that might naturally need a, say, 2-meter-long tube can be packed into one that's maybe only 0.5 meter long. Great for portability and storage.
Clever.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing they're not as cheap as reflectors.
Generally, no. They're more complex to manufacture, so they tend to be pricier than a reflector of the same aperture. And another thing, they often take a bit longer to cool down to the outside air temperature for the sharpest views because of the closed tube and the corrector lens.
Right. Thermal equilibrium. Okay, so we've got the optics sorted. Refractors, reflectors, catadioptrics.
Mm-mm.
But you mentioned something else being crucial.
Yeah.
The mount.
Absolutely critical. Cottrell really hammers this point home. He basically says a fantastic telescope on a shaky, inadequate mount is completely useless.
Why useless?
Think about it. You're magnifying a tiny point of light hundreds of times. Any tiny vibration in the mount wind, you touching the focus knob gets magnified just as much. The image in the eyepiece just dances around like crazy. It's impossible to see anything clearly.
Okay. That makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to just focus on the telescope tube itself.
Very easy. So Cottrell explains the two main types of mounts. First is the alt-azimuth, or alt-az. It's simple, intuitive, moves up and down altitude and left and right azimuth, like a heavy-duty camera tripod. The Dobsonian mount we mentioned is a type of alt-az.
Simple, sounds good. What's the downside?
Well, the stars appear to move across the sky because the Earth is rotating, right? With an alt-az mount, you have to constantly nudge the telescope in both directions, up, down, and left, right, to keep the object centered in the eyepiece, especially at higher magnifications.
Okay, so constant adjustments. That could get annoying if you're trying to really study something or show it to someone else.
Exactly. Which brings us to the other main type, the equatorial mount. This one's a bit more complex initially.
How so?
It has one axis tilted to be parallel to the Earth's axis of rotation. Once you align it properly with the North Star, Polaris, here in the Northern Hemisphere.
Then what?
Then, to track a star or planet as it moves across the sky due to Earth's rotation, you only need to turn one knob or engage one motor on that one tilted axis. It perfectly counteracts the Earth's spin.
Ah. So you find your object, lock it in, and it just stays there.
Stays right in the center of the eyepiece. It's essential for relaxed, high magnification viewing and absolutely necessary for astrophotography, where you need long exposures.
Wow, okay, that's a game changer. That single tracking motion. And that's where those computerized go-to systems come in, right?
Yep. Many modern mounts, both alt-az and equatorial, can be equipped with go-to computers. You tell it you want to see, say, the Andromeda Galaxy, and the motors slew the telescope right to it and then start tracking it automatically.
That sounds amazing for beginners struggling to find faint objects.
It's a huge help. Takes away a lot of the initial frustration of navigating the night sky, but the underlying mount still needs to be solid and stable. Go-to doesn't fix a wobbly foundation.
Good point. Okay, so we have the scope, the mount. What about accessories? Eyepieces seem important.
Crucial. The eyepiece is what actually creates the image you look at and determines the magnification. Cottrell's advice here is really practical. Quality over quantity. Meaning it's much better to have two or three really good quality eyepieces. Maybe a low power for wide views, a medium power, and a high power, than a whole kit full of cheap, poor quality ones.
What makes an eyepiece good?
Sharpness across the whole field of view, good eye relief so it's comfortable to look through, good contrast. Cheap eyepieces often look sharp only in the very center. And beyond the gear, Cottrell talks about the human element, the observing skills you need to develop. One key technique is averted vision.
Averted vision, looking away.
Sort of. Your peripheral vision, the rods in your retina away from the center, are actually more sensitive to faint light than the cones in the very center. So for really faint objects like a dim galaxy or nebula, you learn to look slightly to the side of where it should be in the eyepiece. Often the object will suddenly pop into view in your peripheral vision when you couldn't see it looking directly at it.
Huh. That's fascinating. So you actually have to train your eye how to see faint things better.
Absolutely. Observing isn't just passive looking. It's an active skill you develop with patience and practice.
Okay, pulling back a bit from the technical details, what are some of the big overarching themes or messages Cottrell emphasizes?
Well, the first one we already talked about quite a bit. Aperture is king, that fundamental principle.
Right, the light bucket.
It cuts through the marketing noise. It's basic physics, and understanding it helps you evaluate any technical product, really, focusing on what truly matters.
Another theme I picked up on was knowledge precedes purchase. He really wants to arm you before you spend any money.
Definitely. He's trying to help you avoid those classic beginner mistakes like buying a big, impressive-looking scope on a mount that's way too weak for it. That just guarantees frustration. Knowledge is your defense.
Yeah, that makes sense. What else?
I think a really nice one is the unity of technology and wonder. Cottrell argues that understanding the technical side, the optics, the mechanics, doesn't diminish the awe of seeing Saturn's rings. If anything, it enhances it.
How so?
Because you appreciate what it took for that light to travel millions of miles and then get focused perfectly by this instrument into your eye. The understanding deepens the wonder.
I like that. Technology enabling, not reducing the magic.
And maybe one more. Observing is an acquired skill. Success doesn't just happen. You need patience. You need practice. You need to train your eye, learn the sky.
It's like learning any craft, really.
Exactly. It parallels achieving mastery in almost anything. It requires dedication.
The book also has some really memorable ways of phrasing things, almost philosophical ideas. You mentioned one earlier.
Ah, yes. Light is the currency of the universe. The more of it you can collect, the richer your views will be.
It just perfectly captures that aperture principle, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Simple, elegant, and profoundly true for astronomy. Focus on collecting that currency.
Then there's the idea he calls the time machine effect.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that one.
He says something like, every photon that enters your telescope has traveled billions of years to meet your eye. You are not just observing the universe. You are participating in its history.
Wow. That really shifts your perspective. Looking at the Andromeda Galaxy, you're seeing light from 2.5 million years ago. You're literally looking back in time.
It connects you to the deep past in a very direct, tangible way. Pretty mind-blowing when you stop and think about it.
And here's one that's maybe more about the why. The difference between a good telescope and a great telescope is not just optical quality. It's the inspiration it provides and the questions it compels you to ask.
I love that one. It reminds us that the gear is a tool. But the real value is the curiosity it sparks, the journey of learning it encourages. Does it make you want to know more? That's a great telescope.
And maybe the most personal one. Your first view of Saturn's rings, is the moment the universe ceases to be an abstract concept in a textbook and becomes a real place you can visit with your own eyes.
Ah, that moment. For so many astronomers, that's the hook, seeing Saturn's rings or Jupiter's moons for the first time. It makes it real. It's not just a picture anymore.
It becomes a place.
Yeah, a place you've visited. Thinking about the practical side, the skills you gain from this hobby actually bleed over into other parts of life, too.
Like what?
Well, think about the patience and mindfulness. Setting up gear carefully, waiting for the scope to cool, patiently searching for a faint object, waiting for moments of steady air.
Yeah, it's not exactly instant gratification.
Not at all. It forces you to slow down, to concentrate, to be present. That kind of focused attention is pretty valuable these days, a good antidote to constant distraction.
That makes sense. And you're also problem solving all the time, right?
Totally. You're constantly cultivating a scientific mindset.
Mm-hmm.
Is the view blurry because of bad focus, bad seeing conditions in the atmosphere, dew on the lens, mirrors needing collimation?
You're testing hypotheses constantly.
Exactly. Troubleshooting, analyzing evidence, those are skills useful anywhere.
And maybe the biggest impact.
I think it has to be the shift in perspective.
Yeah.
Regularly looking at things like the Andromeda Galaxy, 2.5 million light years away, or nebulae where stars are being born.
Puts your daily hassles in context.
Dramatically so. It provides this powerful dose of humility, the sense of scale. It doesn't make your problems disappear, but it definitely reframes them against the vastness of space and time.
For me, thinking back, maybe the most surprising technical thing was really grasping the necessity of the equatorial mount for Sirius viewing, just to counteract Earth's rotation. It seems obvious stars move, but realizing how that fundamentally impacts instrument design, that was eye-opening. Cottrell does a great job of making those technical choices feel logical, not just intimidating jargon. It felt empowering.
And that leads nicely into what I think is the final, maybe most provocative takeaway. By learning the gear, the physics, the skills, like averted vision, you sort of become this cosmic archaeologist.
Cosmic archaeologist. How so?
You're connected to the past, Galileo, Newton, the photons that traveled for eons. But you're also actively participating in discovery, even if it's just personal discovery. The lasting insight for me is that the technical knowledge, the understanding, it doesn't kill the magic. It actually enhances our capacity for awe. It deepens the wonder.
It really does shift it from just looking to actively participating in something vast and historical and scientific. A really powerful guide for anyone thinking about taking that leap.
Absolutely. A great foundation.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.